disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dasha, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, August 21st issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In Capital Account by Greg Ipp, Treasury's haven status fades. This year's upward march in bond yields has many drivers, from sticky inflation to heavy AI-linked corporate borrowing. Lurking in the background, though, is a more troubling possibility. Treasuries, long the world's preferred safe asset, are looking less safe. Relative to other securities, their yields are no longer quite so low, and in moments of stress, they don't behave like a haven. The main reason for this is that since the pandemic, the U.S. has flooded the market with additional debt, reaching $40 trillion, including intergovernment debt. This week, there is no sign that the flood will abate. The U.S. Treasury's surprise announcement Wednesday that it would boost buybacks of less liquid, longer-term debt simply treats the symptoms rather than the underlying cause. The move, while reducing yields in the short run, might yet raise them in the long run by eroding the U.S.'s reputation for stability and predictability. Treasury debt has long enjoyed a unique status globally. It's backed by the unparalleled economic and financial strength of the United States, denominated in the world's preferred reserve currency, and is overseen by strong and stable laws and institutions, in particular the Federal Reserve and the Treasury itself. Treasuries don't just fund the U.S. government. They are where investors and governments like to park extra cash, for example, to defend their currencies. They are used to price, hedge, and collateralize countless transactions in unrelated markets. This status brought a safety premium, conferring lower everyday borrowing costs for the U.S. and virtually unlimited financing capacity. These benefits became especially apparent in the wake of the global financial crisis. U.S. borrowing soared, yet yields fell. The reason? Private borrowing collapsed, and securities once thought safe, such as AAA-rated mortgages, turned out not to be safe. The Fed and other central banks began buying their own government's debt. This led to what Ricardo Caballero, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, dubbed the, quote, safe asset shortage, end quote. As investors' demand for super safe assets collided with a finite supply, yields plummeted. Those conditions ended with the pandemic, when inflation and interest rates rose and deficits shot up. In a recent study, Caballero finds that instead of investors accepting lower yields because treasuries are so desirable, they are demanding higher yields. The safety premium has become an absorption premium. One way Caballero infers this is by comparing treasury yields to swaps, derivatives used to manage interest exposure that serve as sort of benchmark for corporate borrowing costs. Historically, treasuries yielded less than swap rates, but recently they have yielded more. He sees this as reflecting the greater strain dealers now bear to trade, warehouse, and distribute debt. Another clue comes from the term premium, the extra return investors demand to hold long-term bonds instead of shorter-term treasury bills. That term, premium, has steadily marched higher. Combining these two, Caballero infers that the shift from a safety premium to an absorption premium explains about 0.75 percentage point of the roughly 2.5 percentage point rise in yields since 2015. A separate study by Hanno Lustig at Stanford University comes to similar conclusions. Historically, treasuries yielded less than AAA corporate bonds, even after adjusting for default risk. But since 2022, that advantage has disappeared. Treasury yields were also comparable to or lower than other sovereign bonds when hedged into dollars, but have generally been higher since the pandemic. The study, prepared for the Aspen Economic Strategy Group, of which I'm a member, listed signs that investors no longer flee to the safety of treasuries during stress periods as they once did. When stocks go down, yields now tend to go up. For example, following President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs last year, News of larger deficits tends to put upward pressure on yields, Lustig found. All of this, he argues, shows treasuries are seen as less safe. There could be other explanations for these developments, for example, related to market functioning or inflation. These dynamics cannot be attributed solely to Trump, since they were underway before he took office. But he also hasn't reversed them. Early on, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Trump's priority was lower bond yields, which influence mortgage rates. This, he said, would be achieved through increased energy production that reduces inflation, AI-driven productivity, and a lower budget deficit, which was $1.8 trillion in fiscal 2024. Instead, the Iran war has driven up energy prices and inflation. Meanwhile, the Congressional Budget Office projects the deficit will reach $2.1 trillion this year. As a share of gross domestic product, that is double the 3% target Bessent once envisioned. At the same time, corporations will issue a record $1.9 trillion in investment-grade debt this year, much of it to finance the AI build-out, according to Barclays. All of this has pushed bond yields higher instead of lower. So, rather than address the fundamentals behind higher yields, Bessent has turned to fiddling with the bond market itself. Rather than expand bond auctions, he's financing the deficit with more treasury bills and hinted that auctions of some bonds might actually shrink. He intervened to boost the Japanese yen to keep Japanese interest rates from rising and spilling into the U.S. while suggesting Japan borrow from the Fed to finance yen buying without selling treasuries. Since the 1970s, Democratic and Republican Treasury departments alike have sought to make debt issuance regular and predictable, rather than trying to time the market. Bond sales were detailed at quarterly refundings. Buybacks launched in 2024 to improve liquidity in little traded issues were similarly scheduled at the same time. Bessent has also endorsed regular and predictable, yet departed from it in announcing the buyback Wednesday, just 2 weeks after the last quarterly refunding. The buyback caught investors offside and thus achieved its short-term goal. Yields fell, but such progress might not be sustained. If issuance and buybacks are no longer regular or predictable, bonds might become more volatile. Investors might demand a higher yield to account for this extra unpredictability, said Blake Gwynn, head of U.S. rates strategy at RBC Capital Markets. By shifting from bonds to bills, Treasury faces more rollover risk, the chance that interest rates will have risen when that debt must be refinanced. However, that might be a problem for a future Treasury Secretary. U.S. leading indicators signal growth. U.S. leading economic indicators edged higher in July as everything except consumer expectations took a turn for the better, indicating moderate growth could be coming. The leading economic index, published by research group The Conference Board, rose by 0.2% to 99.5, following an upwardly revised 0.1% decrease in June. The index's six-month growth rate is now positive, rising 0.2% between January and July, which is a sharp reversal from the 1.3% contraction from the prior 6 months, the Conference Board said. This is the first time in 4 years that the LEI's six-month growth rate has turned positive, which suggests some moderate growth ahead, according to Justina Zabinska-Lamonica, a senior manager at the Conference Board. This was by Dean Seal. Jessica Coachi offers manufacturing in Philadelphia area expands. Manufacturing activity in the Philadelphia area continued to expand past expectations this month, according to a survey from the Philly Fed. In the Reserve Bank's Manufacturing Business Outlook Survey, the current activity index rose to 47.4 in August from 41.4 in July. A reading above zero indicates that an increase in business activity. Economists polled by the Wall Street Journal were expecting a reading of 25. The current new orders and shipments indexes both declined, but remained above their long-run non-recession averages, the report said. Price increases were less widespread this month, but both price indexes remained elevated, the survey said. The prices paid index fell 13 points to 40.9 in August. The current prices received index also declined. The employment index rose 18 points to 27.9, its highest reading since April 2022. The survey covers businesses in the Philly Fed's district, which includes Delaware and parts of eastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey. Again from Dean Seal, we have jobless claims pull back after recent run-up. U.S. jobless claims eased lower last week after climbing for nearly a month. The number of people who filed for unemployment benefits was 206,000 in the week through August 15th, 6,000 lower than the upwardly revised 206,000, not 100,000, reported a week earlier, the Labor Department said Thursday. Economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal were expecting 210,000. Continuing claims, which scale with the total size of the unemployment population, totaled just under 1.8 million in the week through August 8th, rising by 18,000 from the upwardly revised total of 1.78 million a week earlier. The data on continuing claims lag the initial claims data by a week. Unemployment levels have fluctuated throughout the summer from a mixture of slow hiring with relatively few major rounds of layoffs. Policymakers have suggested that labor markets look close to equilibrium and isn't a major source of inflation pressure right now. The California startup investment dwarfs the rest of the U.S. combined, by Paul Kiernan. California is in the midst of a record-shattering investment wave, fueled by their artificial intelligence boom in Silicon Valley. Companies based in the Golden State have drawn around $366 billion of venture capital since the beginning of the year, according to data provider PitchBook. That's more than three times the amount of venture funding that's gone into the other 49 states combined, and nearly double California's previous record, set in 2025. New York State ranks a distant second in venture capital investment with $27 billion in deals announced so far this year. California's funding keeps coming, despite the threat of a billionaire tax that detractors, including Governor Gavin Newsom, have warned could scare off investors. Thus far, at least, investments in the biggest AI companies are keeping the frenzy going, while the state's billionaire class waits to see if voters back the new levy, in November. The capital pouring into AI has supercharged housing prices in San Francisco and created a new class of millionaires overnight. But the boom is reverberating beyond the tech-centric Bay Area. The money has also helped ease the state government's chronic budget deficit by helping push income tax revenues well above forecasts. In May 2025, California's finance department projected $126 billion in personal income tax revenues for the fiscal year that ended June 30th. Actual income taxes instead generated around $147 billion as AI enthusiasm fueled the soaring stock market and boosted compensation for tech workers. Future initial public offerings of young AI companies that are raising venture funding today will produce additional tax revenue from capital gains. The windfall hasn't solved California's long-term budget challenges, but has given state leaders some unexpected near-term flexibility. The state was able to sock away more money in reserves and spend more on education, which is required to get a certain share of revenues. The extra tax revenue also gave the state wiggle room, as it funded discretionary items from new courthouses to litter abatement. The funding deployed by venture capital firms on behalf of investors, including pension funds, university endowments, and wealthy individuals, is funneled into young companies and startups that show potential for robust growth. Just two AI companies have accounted for more than half of California's venture capital gold rush this year. In March, OpenAI raised $122 billion in the largest funding round in Silicon Valley history. Rival AI developer Anthropic, meanwhile, has drawn $95 billion across two funding rounds. But smaller hauls are spread widely, with more than 4,000 California-based startups having raised capital in 2026, according to PitchBook. In addition to AI companies, some of the more recent deals include a $1.37 billion funding round announced on August 6th by Torrance-based defense manufacturing startup Hadrian Automation, as well as a $545 million raise by live commerce platform Whatnot on August 7th. New technologies often agglomerate or cluster in a specific geographic region, whether it's the auto industry in Detroit, the movie business in Los Angeles, or previous tech booms in the Bay Area. But the latest concentration of AI investment in Silicon Valley is particularly extreme, said Enrico Moretti, a University of California at Berkeley economist who has studied the geography of jobs. It's an amount of agglomeration that surpasses even previous waves, Moretti said. The phenomenon, he said, reflects the extraordinary returns to creativity and innovation, which research suggests can be bolstered by people working in proximity to one another and sharing ideas. A thick labor market of workers with specialized skills and firms that need them also helps, Moretti said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Taking a look at the opinion page, Thomas Beck, a former executive with HCA Healthcare, also served as an advisor to both Trump presidential transitions and as a consultant to the Department of Government Efficiency, has offered the Medicare for All math doesn't add up. The notion of a Medicare for All system is enjoying a revival. Democratic primary victories by candidates who champion single-payer health care, most notably U.S. Senate candidates Abdul El-Sayed in Michigan and Peggy Flanagan in Minnesota, have pushed the proposal back into the health care debate. What these candidates fail to understand, or refuse to acknowledge, is that applying Medicare payment rates to all services provided to all patients would destroy the American health care system. The debate usually centers on taxes and the role of government. But there is a more fundamental question. Could America's hospitals survive if every patient were reimbursed at Medicare rates? The answer is no. This isn't ideology, it's math. Congress's Medicare Payment Advisory Commission estimates that hospitals lost about 12 cents on every Medicare dollar they received in 2024 and projects Medicare margins will remain roughly 10% below the break-even point in 2026. Those losses are sustainable only because Medicare is one part of a mixed payer system. The other main part is commercial insurance. A 2024 RAND study found that private insurers paid hospital, on average, more than 2.5 times Medicare rates. Those much higher payments help support emergency departments, trauma centers, neonatal intensive care units, behavioral health programs, teaching hospitals, and rural facilities, as well as investment in technology, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. In effect, America's hospitals are financed by a combination of public underpayment and private overpayment. The arrangement may not be elegant or even rational, but it keeps hospitals operating. Medicare for All would destroy that balance. Supporters respond that hospitals could simply become more efficient. Greater efficiency is desirable, but it can't bridge a reimbursement gap of this magnitude. Hospitals aren't ordinary businesses. They can't close the emergency department on a slow day or staff an intensive care unit only when demand is high. They must maintain nurses, physicians, technicians, operating rooms, diagnostic equipment, and emergency readiness around the clock. If Congress imposed a regime that paid Medicare rates for every patient, hospitals would first freeze hiring, delay capital projects, and postpone equipment purchases. Then would come staffing reductions and closing of money-losing services such as obstetrics and behavioral health. Rural hospitals, many already operating on razor-thin margins, would be especially vulnerable. Eventually, many hospitals wouldn't generate enough revenue to meet payroll and keep the lights on. The greatest victims would be the patients Medicare for All is intended to help. Universal insurance means little if the local maternity ward is closed, the nearest trauma center is hours away, or the community hospital has disappeared. A healthcare system can't endure if the institutions providing care consistently lose money treating their patients. Medicare for All may promise universal coverage, but its payment rates couldn't support a sustainable hospital system. Under review and outlook, how the U.S. went $40 trillion in debt. After cheerleading for President Biden's spending binge, the liberal intelligentsia is now ringing alarms about the U.S. government's mounting debt, which surpassed $40 trillion on Tuesday. Naturally, the left is blaming the GOP's tax cuts, but this argument is like scarfing double cheeseburgers and then blaming weight gain on the lettuce and tomato. The $40 trillion milestone marks a very dark day for America's finances, Bloomberg News reported, with debt having accelerated faster than predicted, in part due to massive tax cuts under last summer's Republican tax and spending bill. Debt accumulation has accelerated, but the problem is spending by both political parties, including COVID blowout and entitlement programs that keep growing on autopilot. Gross national debt has increased $17 trillion since 2019. That's about as much debt as the U.S. added during the entire first 225 years of its history. While the liberal press blames the GOP's 2017 tax cuts and their extension in last year's One Big Beautiful Bill, revenue has increased 68% since 2018. That's twice the rate of inflation. Since 2018, revenue has averaged about 17% of GDP, roughly the historical norm. Yet spending has averaged slightly over 24% of GDP versus a pre-pandemic historical average of 20%. Congress's initial COVID relief bill in March 2020 might have been warranted to help mitigate the lockdown's economic damage, but many provisions, such as extra Medicaid and food stamp allotments, didn't lapse until 2023. A bipartisan Congress piled on more spending that December. Then, after Democrats took over Congress, they fired off another round in March 2021, even though the economy had mostly recovered. Then came the bipartisan infrastructure bonanza, followed by a pork-laden bill to subsidize computer chips, and, to top it off, a climate extravaganza the Democrats hilariously named the Inflation Reduction Act. This largesse has cost more than the Congressional Budget Office originally estimated. Even so, the biggest contributors to soaring deficits fall under the category of mandatory spending, including Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, veteran benefits, and Obamacare subsidies. All of this is finally getting noticed now that the government has to pay higher interest rates. U.S. debt service payments totaled $963 billion during the first 10 months of this fiscal year. That's $200 billion more than spending on defense, and it's even slightly more than Medicare. Republicans in last year's tax bill made modest reforms to Medicaid, food stamps, and student loans, and they also rolled back some green energy subsidies. Alas, these changes don't go far enough, and the GOP has shrunk from making bigger reforms. The press is playing up the $40 trillion milestone and rising interest rates to scare Republicans off further tax cuts, to give the economy a supply-side boost, and to justify tax increases when Democrats next control Congress. President Trump's advisors are reportedly noodling with the good idea of adjusting capital gains for inflation. But the policy answer on the debt is spending restraint, and one reason yields on long-term treasuries might be going up is that investors have concluded that neither party intends to quit the double cheeseburgers. And from Joseph Sternberg in his political economics column, the bond chaos is a sign Kevin Warsh's plan is working. What an exciting week for bond markets isn't generally a phrase one wants to hear, but here we are. Yields on U.S. Treasuries surged on Monday and Tuesday, especially at longer end, with the 30-year briefly hitting a level last seen in 2007. Yields fell back down again on Wednesday after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced an intervention. Starting next month, Treasury will accelerate its buyback of longer-dated bonds and issue shorter-term debt instead. One of the sillier interpretations of these events is that somehow Federal Reserve Chairman Kevin Warsh is failing at his new job. In this telling, an excess of dovishness is causing long yields to rise in expectation of future inflation. Meanwhile, Mr. Bessent's intervention supposedly is a repudiation of Mr. Warsh's determination to keep government hands off the bond market. Something much more interesting is afoot. The most convincing explanation for the surge in yields is an uptick in expectations for future economic growth. This is manifested by the willingness of tech companies to bid up interest rates as they borrow to invest in artificial intelligence. It's the latest sign that financial repression is unwinding, and not a moment too soon. The term refers to a suite of economic policies, the details vary at different times and places, designed to allow the government to borrow at below market rates at the expense of savers and with woeful distortions throughout the economy. This has been the dominant policy mode across the West since the 2008 financial panic. Financial repression in the U.S. is enforced primarily by the Federal Reserve via the expansion of its balance sheet under quantitative easing. The central bank bought treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, which it then held as assets on its balance sheet. In exchange, it created large new liabilities in the form of commercial banks' reserve deposits at the central bank. Banks were encouraged to hoard these reserves, both by black-letter liquidity regulations and by strenuous winking and nodding by their supervisors at the Fed. The central bank also released a constant stream of forward guidance, hinting at low rates in the future to deter markets from bidding up yields. The effect of this on the government's consolidated balance sheet was to exchange more expensive debt, treasuries held by the public, for much cheaper debt, reserve balances, on which the Fed paid lower interest. The net reduction in effective borrowing costs was achieved by the central bank's remittances to the Treasury of its profits from this arrangement, which can be understood as a rebate of some of the interest Treasury paid to the Fed on the bonds the Fed now owned. It was a great deal for spendthrifts in Congress, facilitating a run-up in federal debt at interest rates that hardly seem to represent the true risks of this situation. And it may be ending now. Despite the obvious ways this arrangement entangled the central bank with the Treasury, the Fed retained enough independence to raise policy rates after inflation took hold in 2021 and 2022. By late 2022, the interest rate paid on reserves started to exceed the yield on the Fed's holding of Treasury debt, a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for ending this form of financial repression. Now, perhaps we're entering a new phase. Mr. Warsh is adamant about shrinking the Fed's balance sheet. This would disable the primary mechanism by which the Fed Treasury complex has suppressed government borrowing costs. And under his no forward guidance rubric, he isn't delivering the central bank's usual vague reassurances that rates probably will fall in the future. This has kicked out another crutch on which the Treasury once could lean. The result is a world where companies and investors are newly able to price risk in line with expected economic growth. For now, that means interest rates returning to their level before financial repression began in earnest in 2008. The big losers are lawmakers who must pay market rates for debt. Interest payments are on track to be either the second or third largest federal expenditure in this fiscal year, behind Social Security and maybe Medicare. Expect that cost to grow as investors internalize the notion that the Fed may not always allow itself to become a backstop. Whether or when this might become a financial crisis is a matter of debate, but it will become a political crisis soon, once Congress starts confronting some awkward realities about what constitutes affordable fiscal policy if the Fed no longer is subsidizing lawmakers' bad decisions. Seen in this light, Mr. Bessent's bond intervention isn't a challenge to Mr. Warsh's hands-off approach to the government debt market, but rather a sign that Mr. Warsh's approach is starting to work. Mr. Bessent's move is the first, clumsy and likely ineffective, attempt by a politician to grapple with the implications of interest rates that are allowed to rise in line with economic growth. There will have to be more adjustments. Brace yourselves. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Turning to the business and finance section, employers and workers face a rise in healthcare costs by Anna Wild Matthews and Peter Loftus. Healthcare costs are walloping U.S. workers, and they will only worsen next year. For 2027, employers may be facing the biggest health insurance increase in at least two decades. Americans with workplace coverage are expected to spend an average $5,297 this year on health care, $388 more than 2025, according to a new estimate from benefits consulting firm Aon. The spending represents a combination of payroll deductions for premiums and out-of-pocket charges like deductibles and copays. The burden is likely to grow significantly next year when U.S. employers expect their health care costs to go up by 11%, according to a new survey from WTW, another big benefits consultant, the steepest rise in more than 20 years. That would represent the fifth year of escalating increases, according to WTW. Employers are telling us that this is utterly unsustainable, said Jeff Levenshurtz, population health leader at WTW. Expensive cancer treatments and wide adoption of weight loss drugs are among the factors pushing up spending. At larger companies, the rapid rise has moved decision around health benefits from the domain of human resources executives into the C-suite, said Mike Pasterick, North America Health Solutions leader at Aon. We're seeing a lot of interest now from the finance organization and even the CEO and the board. As companies are forced to pay more for insurance, their workers, who typically pay a share of the premium, are seeing their own costs rise roughly in tandem. That means more dollars are held out of their paychecks each month. At Paul Wismatch Glass Company, which employs 35 people in Payton City, West Virginia, co-owner Jason Wilburn said he's been hit by double-digit premium increases each year since his family bought the company in 2021. Health insurance expenses are now consume about 5% of the firm's revenue, more than its profit margin. This year, the company raised the biweekly payroll deduction for a single worker to $50 from $40. Though the employer is still paying about 90% of the total premium, a few workers decided to drop their coverage when their costs went up. It's frustrating and sad, Wilburn said. Something's got to change. Americans are paying more out of pocket for health care in the form of deductibles, copayments, and coinsurance, as well as expenses not covered by their insurance, according to federal data. Health care spending recently has risen more quickly than income, said Michael Chernu, a healthcare policy professor at Harvard Medical School. The accelerating increase in health insurance costs and workers' expenses is fueled by a variety of factors, according to benefits consultants and insurers. Hospitals have been able to win price increases and are increasingly using artificial intelligence tools to boost their billing, leading to higher payments. Workers are also using more medical services and taking high-cost drugs for an array of conditions. Among the major causes for rising costs are cancer treatments and the popular diabetes and weight loss drugs known as GLP-1s. Employee utilization of GLP-1 drugs for weight loss grew 75% in 2025 across Aon's clients, the firm said. In business news, Starbucks plans more layoffs, by Heather Haddon. Starbucks will lay off more than 200 corporate staff, continuing a strategy to tighten its operations 2 years into a turnaround effort pursued by Chief Executive Brian Niccol. The Seattle company plans to cut about 120 technology workers, according to the company, after those staff declined to relocate to Nashville, Tennessee, where a new corporate office is being built. Starbucks is cutting an additional 104 jobs in coffeehouse design and development. Starbucks, the world's largest coffee chain, is working toward Niccol's goal of eliminating $2 billion in costs by the end of its 2028 fiscal year. It is also investing more heavily in its cafe operations. The company recently estimated that its U.S. stores are nearly all fully staffed, and most in-store and drive-through orders are being delivered within 4 minutes, a target set by Niccol. Under Niccol, Starbucks has scrutinized its store base, closing locations that haven't performed, don't provide the right store environment, or should be relocated. Niccol has said that Starbucks needs to focus its operations to better serve this strategy. The job cuts, detailed in a filing in a Washington state, don't involve shutting down cafes. Starbucks last month reported quarterly earnings and sales that outpaced analysts' expectations and increased its forecast for a full-year same-store sales and earnings. Executives have said the turnaround efforts are gaining traction. Earlier this year, Starbucks laid off 300 U.S. corporate employees while closing regional corporate offices in Chicago, Atlanta, Dallas, and Burbank, California. The company is developing a $100 million corporate office in Nashville, which will house 2,000 employees, including technology and supply chain functions. Starbucks in 2025 laid off around 2,000 corporate workers while eliminating hundreds of open positions and closing hundreds of U.S. stores. Deere's profit rises as revenue climbs, by Connor Hart. Deere posted higher profit and sales in its fiscal third quarter as continued growth in the company's construction equipment business helped to offset continuing weakness in its production agricultural segment. The company posted a profit of $1.38 billion for 3 months, ending August 2nd, compared with $1.29 billion in last year's comparable period. On a per-share basis, quarterly earnings of $5.10 a share topped the $4.69 a share that analysts polled by FactSet expected. Net sales and revenue climbed 6.2% to $11 billion, ahead of Wall Street models for $10.81 billion. The total top-line figure came in at $12.61 billion. Sales across the company's production and precision agriculture division, its largest business unit, came in at $4 billion, down 6.4% from a year ago. The company attributed the decrease primarily to lower shipment volumes. The decline was offset by construction and forestry sales, which jumped 18% to $3.62 billion, and small agriculture and turf sales, which rose 12% to $3.38 billion. Chief Executive John May said Deere continues to believe 2026 will mark the bottom of the current agriculture equipment cycle. Deere raised the low end of its net income outlook to $4.75 billion from $5 billion, while maintaining the high end at $5 billion. Shares advanced nearly 7% to $620.94 in Thursday's trading. JD Sports shares tumble after profit guidance cut by Michael Hennessy. JD Sports fashion shares dropped after the retailer cut its full-year profit guidance as second quarter sales fell due to pricing pressure and a weak U.S. performance. Shares slid 14% in London Thursday. JD Sports cut its fiscal 2027 guidance for adjusted pre-tax profit, the company's preferred metric, which strips out exceptional and other one-off items due to underlying sales trends and a promotional backdrop in the sector. The company now expects adjusted pre-tax profit of between £700 million and £800 million, or $952.5 million to $1.09 billion for fiscal 2027. It previously forecast adjusted pre-tax profits between £750 million and £850 million after reporting adjusted pre-tax profit of £852 million for the year ended January 31st, 2026. Analysts had forecast adjusted pre-tax profit of £781 million for fiscal 2027, according to the consensus provided by the company. JD Sports said group sales for its second quarter ended August 1st fell 3.1% on a like-for-like basis to £3.09 billion. On an organic basis, sales were down 1.3%. Trading in the second quarter remained tough. The market stayed highly promotional, reflecting the consumer and footwear product cycle headwinds our industry has faced in recent quarters, whilst our core consumer was impacted by incremental cost of living pressures, said Chief Executive Regis Schultz. North American sales in the second quarter were down 6.8% on a comparable basis, as incremental cost of living pressures hit particularly strongly in the region. The region generates around 35% of group sales. North America sales performance reflects weaker core customer sentiment, a slower quarter for high heat footwear product, and deferred back-to-school demand from July into the first half of August, the company said. Sales for the U.S. were notably weaker than expected, partly due to a soft performance for retail chain Finish Line, Bernstein analysts noted. Weak housing market hits Hovnanian. Hovnanian Enterprises, this is by Connor Hart, continues to cope with a stagnant housing market, plagued by cautious consumers who are too anxious to buy new homes. World events, as well as high mortgage rates, high gas prices, inflation, and other factors, have caused potential home buyers to hesitate, Chief Executive Ara Hovnanian said on a call with analysts Thursday. The hesitancy has forced the home builder to offer expensive incentives to spur sales, cutting into its bottom line and prompting the company to post its second consecutive quarterly loss. Contracts also declined, hurting its top line as well. Shares tumbled 7.5% to $118.13 in Thursday's trading. Despite the drop, the stock is up 21% in the year to date. Other home builders are feeling the pressure too. Toll Brothers, a luxury home builder, earlier this week reported lower sales in the latest quarter as it delivered fewer homes. And Lennar, in June, cut its full-year deliveries outlook after it similarly reported declining revenue. Hovnanian said underlying demand for housing remains strong, noting that the company's website continues to see solid traffic and that consumers continue to tour its communities. However, Hovnanian Enterprises is having a hard time converting interest into home sales. Compared with last year's third quarter, our results continue to reflect the reality of a housing market operating under substantially higher mortgage rates, elevated incentives, and concern about global instability, Hovnanian said. Quarterly contracts declined roughly 4% to 1,359 homes. The decrease in contracts weighed on revenue, which fell 12% to $705.7 million. The company swung to a loss of $1.8 million for its 3 months ending July 31st, from a profit of $16.6 million a year earlier. On a per-share basis, the company reported a loss of 70 cents a share, compared with earnings of $1.99 a share a year prior. While the housing market, by and large, is still heavily reliant on incentives to push new home contracts, the incentives are starting to come down. Incentive levels have declined sequentially for the past two quarters, Hovnanian said, even though mortgage rates have increased over the same period. In the short money and investing pieces, in the stock spotlight, shares in the crypto-related companies jumped after President Trump had a friendly meeting with digital currency leaders at the White House. Strategy gained 7.8%, Coinbase rose 7.6%, and American Bitcoin increased 7.2%. Walmart posted its weakest sales growth in over 6 years. Shares declined 9.2%. Shares closed down nearly 25% after Advance Auto Parts reported a decline in both same-store and net sales, noting fewer people were picking up DIY projects for their automobiles. Alibaba's U.S.-listed shares rose 1.3%, slightly reversing an earlier slight fall after it reported a steep drop-off in profit amid heavy investments in artificial intelligence. Coty, the beauty company, reported a bigger loss and forecast a drop in sales in the current quarter. Shares dropped 9.2%. Deere shares climbed 6.9% after the machinery maker's quarterly profit topped expectations, despite continued weakness in its large farm equipment business. Bitcoin leaps on bond intervention, crypto summit. Bitcoin has broken out of its summer doldrums, rallying more than 12%. Over the past 2 days, in the wake of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's intervention in the bond market and an upbeat White House cryptocurrency summit, the digital currency rose above $72,600 on Thursday. It was the first time Bitcoin traded above the $70,000 level since early June. Bessent's plans to step up buybacks of long-dated U.S. government bonds push down borrowing costs, which tends to benefit risky assets like Bitcoin. Separately, President Trump urged Congress to pass legislation desired by the digital currency industry during a friendly meeting with crypto executives on Wednesday. This was from Alexander Osipovich. And after a day of exuberance for Moderna, investors pull back. The day after Moderna's stock posted its biggest one-day gain on record, the shares plunged more than 23% as investors digested Wednesday's trial news and adjusted their positions. Prior to Wednesday's rally on positive mRNA cancer vaccine data, Moderna's stock had substantial short interest at 13.7%. A so-called short squeeze, wherein short sellers buy back stock to moderate losses, likely contributed to the stock's meteoric Wednesday rise, analysts said. Thursday's move reflects the market cooling off, they said. Probably you had a lot of shorts who got it wrong, covering, which put a lot of paraffin on the flame, said Brookline Capital Markets analyst Leah Kahn. In the days after, they moderate a bit, and it settles down. UBS said its clients sold a record $44 million in Moderna shares Wednesday, suggesting some investors were cashing out after the rally. The stock traded nearly 200 million shares yesterday, roughly half of shares outstanding, suggesting a significant amount of short covering and fast money repositioning likely occurred in a single session, said UBS analyst Michael Yee. Once that buying demand was exhausted, some pullback was to be expected. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Turning to Heard on the Street, financial analysis and commentary, here's the real problem with stock buybacks. Warren Buffett is normally courteous, but he had some choice words for critics of stock buybacks a few years ago. When you're told that all repurchases are harmful to shareholders or to the country, or particularly beneficial CEOs, you are listening to either an economic illiterate or a silver-tongued demagogue, characters that are not mutually exclusive, he wrote. Note Buffett's emphasis on the word all. Companies need to return cash to investors eventually to be worth owning. For the most part, the differences between doing that via dividends or buybacks are minor. Buybacks give long-term investors a larger stake in a smaller company instead of handing them cash they may not need and a dividend tax bill they really don't. For management, dividends create future expectations, whereas buybacks can be turned on and off. But buybacks aren't always a good idea because sometimes stocks are expensive. Companies that grant lots of stock options can be indifferent because they want to soak up those cheaply issued shares. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, which doesn't pay dividends, suspended buybacks for nearly 2 years, amassing a record cash hoard. Red-hot chipmaker SK Hynix's announcement Wednesday that it would conduct South Korea's largest ever buyback sent its shares higher. It's a head-scratcher, though. Even after a recent slump, the stock was up 470% from a year earlier. Management had ample financial firepower to buy during that ascent and didn't. Even weirder is that they sold nearly the same amount of stock to U.S. investors last month in the biggest share sale ever by a foreign company at an effective price 50% higher than today. At least SK Hynix sold high and is buying lower. U.S. companies often get that backward. S&P 500 members marked what was then a record for buybacks in the same quarter. The dot-com bubble peaked. The effective buyback yield, or the value of repurchases as a ratio of the S&P 500's value, was 1.2%. 3 years later, they spent about 40% less, yet the yield was a third larger. The contrast was even more extreme during the financial crisis. Buybacks hit a record, just as stocks did in 2007. By the spring of 2009, when the market was dirt cheap, buybacks dropped by 85%. Buybacks aren't accounting trickery, and they don't starve companies of capital unless done recklessly. The share of profits returned to investors one way or another has been pretty steady over many decades, but paying a dividend, reducing debt, or building up cash for a rainy day can be better choices sometimes. Executives can't control the business cycle or share prices. They're in the best position to know when they're frothy and don't always act like it. This was by Spencer Jacob. The larger article on Heard on the Street is that hyperscalers' off-grid power push has risks. This is by Jinju Lee. Big technology companies are cobbling together off-grid power systems to match their rushed timelines for artificial intelligence development. What if these systems are glitchy? Off-grid power comes with a hefty price tag and operating risks. Tech giants are pursuing them anyway. Power providers, some of whom don't have much data center experience, are jumping at the chance to sign deals with deep-pocketed customers. But cracks have shown at the few on-site power projects that started up, highlighting potential costs to tech companies and their top power providers. In the U.S., there are 4 operational data centers with off-grid or partially grid-connected power, according to the data provider CleanView. These are XAI's Colossus and Colossus 2, Crusoe's Stargate Abilene, and Vantage Data Center's Vantage VA2. 3 of these already reported issues. This month, Bloomberg reported some data centers experienced cranks breaking off on combustion engines. The report said cracks had formed at gas-fired turbines powering XAI's Colossus data center in Memphis, Tennessee. In response to the report, Solaris Energy Infrastructure, which operates turbines for the campus, didn't directly confirm or deny the existence of turbine cracks on its earnings call, but said its turbines were, quote, in great shape. In an emailed statement, Solaris co-chief executive Bill Zartler said the company had, quote, not seen any extraordinary operating issues or failure rates on our generation equipment. Cracked turbines and broken engine cranks are major failures that require replacement, according to Nina Sadighi, founder of Areda Power Consulting, an electrical engineer who formerly worked at Amazon and Tesla. In July, Vantage Data Centers experienced a critical power failure at its data center campus in Loudoun County, Virginia, forcing the operator to switch over to diesel backup power for about a day, a spokesperson confirmed. Distributed Power Solutions, which Kodiak Gas Services bought earlier this year, operates the on-site power. Crusoe also ran into turbine glitches and other technical problems at Stargate Abilene. According to the information, Stargate partner Oracle runs servers for OpenAI. What's causing these problems? First, AI data centers' power demands can be incredibly taxing on power systems. AI workloads cause massive power demand spikes during computation and a drop-off as those computation results are gathered, according to a paper from Schneider Electric. As data centers get bigger, oscillations could reach hundreds of megawatts or even gigawatts, according to the paper. Big swings can stress and shorten the life of engines and turbines and can even cause shaft fractures, according to consulting firm Wood Mackenzie. The same problem surfaced on power grids when grid-connected data centers suddenly drop power usage. Grid operators have had to scramble to take power supply offline to make sure the sudden excess of supply doesn't damage power plants and infrastructure. Troy Patton, general manager at on-site power provider Alpha Structure, said in an interview that he spoke to a potential hyperscaler client who required a very short power response time, tens of milliseconds rather than hundreds of milliseconds, as the industry is used to. These are response times that no rotating equipment or a lithium battery has ever had to respond to, he said. Second, many off-grid power systems use a mishmash of different power equipment, depending on what was available to buy. It can be challenging to make sure all the different pieces work together. Downtime can be costly for everyone involved. Anthropic is paying XAI a monthly fee of $1.25 billion for computing capacity on Colossus and Colossus 2. While the contract details aren't public, the monthly fee implies that one day's worth of outage could be worth as much as tens of millions of dollars a day, either in lost fees for XAI or the cost to Anthropic of not having that computing power. Outages can be costly for power providers. These providers typically don't get paid for electricity they fail to provide, and in some cases must pay penalties for failing to deliver, according to industry experts. They're typically on the hook for repairing and replacing broken power equipment. Siddiqui said that at one of her clients' former on-site data center power systems, a power provider had to replace equipment worth millions of dollars after a multi-day outage. Power failures are the most acute risk, but a more insidious problem is if equipment keeps degrading more quickly than expected. Higher replacement costs would hurt power providers' margins. Power providers do try to limit their maximum damages. Take Solaris Energy Infrastructure, the power provider to XAI's Colossus campuses. In its contracts, Solaris must refund the customer's fees when it fails to deliver power and must cover the cost of repairing or replacing equipment, according to a public filing. But it can't be held liable for the customer's lost revenue from that downtime. Of course, power providers build in redundancies to make up for these risks and model their best guesses for how long each piece of equipment will last. It's too early to tell if these are short-term learning pains or structural issues. Nobody has enough operating history yet to say how this equipment holds up, Siddiqui said. What is clear is that these data center power loads are challenging enough to cause problems even for experienced large grid operators. The stakes are getting higher because off-grid power systems are getting bigger. Amazon is planning an AI data center campus in Pecos County, Texas, that would use natural gas-powered turbines to generate as much as 7.65 gigawatts of power, according to Cleanville. That is equivalent to 7 or 8 nuclear power plants. If these off-grid glitches are fixable learning pains, then power providers might only take a slight hit on their margins. But at worst, it could lead to losses and a drying up of data center business if hyperscalers scrap their off-grid power plants. At least hyperscalers have highly profitable business models and strong balance sheets. Many of these new power providers don't. In addition to early players such as Solaris and VoltaGrid, many companies in the oil and gas industry, including Liberty Energy, Williams, Cause, Atlas Energy Solutions and Kodiak Gas Services, announced business units that will provide on-site power for data centers. Investors are willing to pay up for those with contracts. Solaris, which signed on 2 additional customers after XAI, fetches an enterprise value that is 10 times forward earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, 19% higher than its oil field service peer group. Tech customers' contracts are enticing indeed. But investors need to keep in mind that off-grid power at this scale is still an experiment. Technical challenges today can turn into financial problems in the future. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 21st issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. and Friday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Dasha. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the Buffalo Criterion. At 8 o'clock, we have the New York Times. And at 9 o'clock, we have Discover Magazine. Stay with us for these readings and more. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.